What's good? Welcome back to Agitator, the only freestyle storytelling podcast starring two Mystic Juggalo Weebs. Tonight, guest starring author Jeremy Bernaugh. Just had the pleasure of narrating his book, When You Bleed to Death, that is available on Audible. The book itself is available on Amazon, all those places. Really great, less than zero-esque journey into harrowing young adult fuckery. Really enjoyed narrating it. Was good.
Not much. I never know how to answer what's good. Like, do you want an actual answer?
No, I'm from Texas, so I just say that. It's like as I passing people, holding the door up is like, hey, what's good?
A real answer to that, getting that audiobook, published and put out there has been kind of a an itch for me. For a couple of years, I've tried to get it done for a while. So to meet you and to have that put out has been really awesome for me. So thank you, but that's also, a really positive thing going on. Sales on it have been pretty good. So thank you for your help getting the word out, and I'm excited to see what people think of it.
Hell yeah. Same. It helped that it was like such a great book, but like I really enjoyed doing that performance too. You just hit me up out of the, it was like a year. I'd put in an audition for it and I was like, I just get this email that's like, hey, this was buried, but I really like this. Would you mind, recording a little sample? And I was like, sure. I hope this doesn't suck because I forgot it'd been so long. I was like, which one was this again? And then I was
Did
like,
I
oh
tell you what
shit,
happened?
yeah.
Because I don't, they changed their format. ACX changed their format. But for me, a year ago, they stopped sending me anything. They were like, this is done. They shut down the like in production status. And then later, they changed everything to where I could access all that again. And so I could see all the auditions that I had missed, and yours was in there. So I reached out, and luckily, you were still active. And we went from there.
Hell yeah. What's up, David?
Nothing.
Nope.
What's up with you guys? Yeah.
What's
What's
your name?
going
Tell me
on,
again.
man? Sorry?
I see JDO, you said, but I call you David?
Yeah, David's fine. That works.
David.
Man of many names. David works. James. I like the line from the movie Snatch that Bullet Tooth Tony says, where Dennis Molina's character goes, "Do I call you Bullet? Do I call you Tooth?" And he goes, "You can call me Susan if it makes you happy." So that's kind of how I feel. But
Yeah,
yeah,
just
David works.
call him Susan.
Don't call me,
David,
don't you fucking call me Susan.
I'm
Yeah.
gonna call you Susan now. How can I not? Okay, so I'm sure that there are viewers that would love to hear this, but also I don't know much about you. What are you all about?
Who, me? This guy
Yeah.
right here?
Yeah.
So I host this podcast with Kelby. I started Broken River Books, which is a small press that has now morphed into a collective that we all are on.
Representing.
Representing, I've been doing it for, man, I started Broken River in 2013. My first book came out in 2010, so I've just kind of been around for a while. Yeah, and I'm kind of just obsessed with story. So what I've been on lately on this podcast and in other places, blogs, etc., is really kind of nuts and bolts figuring plot out, because I feel like Kelby and I are similar in that we're both big time prose writers and we like the way that the poetry of the word sounds. But recently my obsessions have brought me to attempting to understand things like plot, which before it just didn't matter to me at all. Cool stuff happens. That's all you need in a book. But yeah, I've really started to nerd out on that. And I'm a English teacher for high school. That's my day job. But it won't be for long. I got about a month left. And then I kick the kids to the curb and go,
You mean for the summer? You're not like
no, I'm done. I'm done.
retiring.
No,
Okay.
I'm becoming a hitman.
Okay.
But no, I actually am. Retiring from that, doing something else for a while. But yeah, how about you?
I assume that's a congrats. Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I like teaching. I like the kids. They're cool. Honestly, it's just a pay thing, you know, not to get too like brass tacks with it, but
no,
if you're trying to raise a family, teacher salary just doesn't really cut it, unfortunately. But yeah, so how about you? I know that Kelby did your audiobook.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I didn't realize you guys were getting started, or I would have been early because I was just hanging out.
I'm just trying to make up for it, you know. Everybody mm-hmm. all pissed off that we missed a week. We missed 1 week in our long streak, our years long. God, like
135 episodes.
Well, plus all the bonus shit, we were going like nearly 200 episodes of just like cranking that shit out no matter mm-hmm. what.
You guys have gone 200 episodes straight without a break.
Yeah.
And the one thing that tanked you 1 week was pneumonia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you're okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was like, I don't think so. I just can't do it. Not this week.
What was it like, dude? You said it felt like you'd been shot in the lung.
I wanted to die. Oh. I was mm-hmm. like, this is it. This is the end. I watched the new Roadhouse movie twice.
Oh,
that was the highlight of the whole thing. Everything else mm-hmm. sucked. You see the new Roadhouse, Jeremy?
You did. And it's interesting that you just said that about watching it twice, because I watched it real late at night once and I did not get into it. And then I saw you said you loved it. So I gave it another shot and I loved it. I like actually was paying attention to it, where the first time it was just kind of on. And I didn't actually really like it.
That shit slapped. That shit went mm-hmm. so hard. I was like, the pneumonia might be heightening this. Just that like kind of high, like when you're sick and it's like almost like being high because you're just so close to death. But I was like, man, this is just hitting right.
Love that you compared it to Poor Things, because they couldn't be more different.
I just felt like there was a vision in both of those movies, you know. Poor Things, I was like, that movie made me so happy. I was like, oh shit, cinema's back. And then Roadhouse came out. I was like, fuck, man, movies are great again. Just that monster energy feel of like early 2000s movies is what it made me feel. Even though it felt like 80s, it had that like early 2000s aesthetic.
I had never seen the original Roadhouse, so I went back and watched it. And it's not as good, in my opinion, as the new one, but I can see why so many people liked it. Because, it had some stuff going for it. It had a vision for what it was.
Those jeans, the way he rocks those jeans.
Yeah. question though, because I have not seen the original. I, too, thought that the remake was awesome. In the original, is there a crocodile that eats a guy?
No. So.
See, that's when I knew I was in the presence of genius. When the dude gets eaten by is it alligator, crocodile, whatever the hell it is.
It's a crocodile.
Yeah, it was a crocodile. And I was like, yeah, this is gonna be a good movie. And then it kind of follows that formula so perfectly. And the fights are amazing. And I think just Jake Gyllenhaal, I watched it with my wife and she was like, he's such a good actor that it felt like two different movies. She said, but I really liked it. And you just realize that some people are just that good that you can give them, you know, this kind of like 80s B-movie style dialogue, but he really sells it as kind of a scary dude. He's like, do you guys have dental insurance? I'm just checking, like, how close is the hospital? I was like, ooh, that's a banger.
Stabbed
right there.
And he was like, did you think this through?
Yeah. I was eating that shit up. All the one-liners and the, I don't know. There were so many things that kind of wouldn't work for me on paper, but maybe it is just how good Jake Gyllenhaal is or the look of it. I don't know. I saw where some people complained about like CGI fighting. I was like, I have no idea what they're talking about.
Yeah, they didn't feel like it was CGI.
I mean, even if it was, Blade 2, famously, that was like, Blade 2 was early CGI. So I don't know if you guys remember, but there's a part where Blade's fighting the vampire. And then all of a sudden you see like little Gumby figures skipping around and doing, even back then, I thought to myself, like, okay, well, that's that's definitely not real, but it looks fine. It looks cool. It's
that shit is so good. I watch Blade 2 like religiously.
Mm-hmm. Like you, on a regular basis, you go back and rewatch Blade 2.
Yeah.
That is a very interesting character detail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Blade 2 is the best one for sure. Yeah, the Guillermo del Toro Reapers are really good. But I'm curious about your journey. I'm always interested to hear writers' stories. So you can start as far back as you like.
I will give you the truncated version of the long story. So okay. I never really wanted to be a writer per se. I always kind of wanted to pursue drawing, cartoons specifically. I had a, I don't know, kind of a vision for cartoons that I've made a few cartoons and they were trash and I'm never going to show anybody. But when I was in high school, my girlfriend at the time died. And it really set me on the wrong path for a long time. There was a lot of stuff that happened in that time period that really hurt in a way that just became increasingly harder and harder to talk about. Mm-hmm. And it was stuff that really kind of tested my character, and it showed me a lot of the ways that things can go wrong in someone's life. And they sat with me for a long time. And that's kind of one of my flaws, is I have kind of a hard time letting that kind of stuff go. So I just kind of got to a point where I was unhealthy in the way that I couldn't talk to people anymore. Like I couldn't have healthy relationships because I would have just walled myself off. So When You Bleed to Death was initially more about kind of getting out the things that were really hard to say. And as I worked on it, I realized if getting these kind of things out and finding this creative venue for getting these things out was so important to me, it might be important to other people. So instead of just kind of barfing it out and letting it go, I started writers groups and I started working with other people to kind of hone the craft of writing until eventually I published it. And then that's how I met my wife. She, I self-published online. She bought it and she read it and she wrote to me and said, this is a really good story, but you cannot spell for shit. And I wrote to her and was like, we'll fix it. And I hired her to edit it. So then I rewrote it. I got a lot of feedback in that time period. A lot of it was really harsh. And I sat with it for a while and then I rewrote it and had more editorial help. And eventually it became this. And when I put this out, I kind of released all of the trauma that I had built up that I couldn't talk about anymore out into the world and just kind of said, fuck it, here it is. Anybody that has anything to say about this, here it is. Here's all of it. Here's all the shit I can't say to you. Here's all the shit I can't say at a party. Here's all the shit that keeps me from being the person who can be emotionally honest and like vulnerable. And I just let it go. And from there, I've had people reach out to me and say, this is one of the best books I've ever read. And I've had people write out to me and say, hey, this book is trash. Or write to me and say, this book is trash. And like that stuff is always going to happen. But there have been people that have really said to me, like, this book helped me process in a time where I felt dangerous. This is like, I felt super low. I felt suicidal. And this has been one of the things that has helped me talk about it, helped me get it out. And that was the point for me. And that's kind of the journey to where I am now. You know, like I wrote this book a long time ago. It's been 10 years and people are still buying it and they're still talking to me about it. They're still writing to me and saying this is important. And that's why I reached out to Kelby to just give people another venue to be able to potentially appreciate it, to potentially, you know, ingest it and maybe see that you're not alone in the times when things are really hard and you're suffering.
I really like that element to it too, because there's so much modern writing, especially in the sort of prose heavy, like stylistic leaning writing that's just like, ah, fuck plot, it's about whatever. There's like, I still value prose and style over everything, but also heart It's like there's so much shit that's just like, I don't know, pretty words, but too obsessed with being cool or detached or whatever that there's like no, it's like, why did you write this? So like reading shit like yours brought me back to like that kind of feeling. I love, that's the best when people reach out with those kind of words. Like, this helped me. It's like, oh wow, shit. Actually, there's some connection going on beyond just, hey, good job. I really liked, you know, the way the sentence is saying or whatever.
I got one of those messages yesterday. The guy said, my girlfriend has been diagnosed with BPD and bipolar, and this has helped me understand what she's going through so I can talk to her about it. And like, that's it, you know? And you know, it's what you're saying, like prose is great. Art is art, and like art is important, and the value of poetry and prose and that, you know, it's amazing. But if there's no why, if there's no heart, then what are you doing? You know?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. I also like the idea that you put forward there of books being a capsule for pain or any emotion, really. Anything that you want to purge. It reminds me very specifically of the act of banishment in occult rituals, right? Like when you're using an Ouija board, you always say goodbye because otherwise you'll bring the ghost along with you. And that reminds me.
That explains so much that's wrong with my life.
Yeah. Gotta say goodbye, man. Yeah. Gotta say goodbye. But you know, you carry these things around. I think a lot of people do to varying degrees of intensity. And what's really interesting is you can take all of that pain, which might seem counterintuitive because you might be thinking, hey, it's better to, you know, do sunshine and rainbows and not think about that kind of bad stuff. You can put it into shapes on a page, put those shapes on paper, and then other people read those shapes and imagine what you've written, and it acts as a kind of release valve for their own problems. And in that way, there's a kind of viral aspect to books that, well, I guess if viruses can be good, it's a shaky metaphor, but it's kind of like an inoculation, right? Like you're sending this out and giving people a kind of release, because the number one thing when you have pain like that is feeling like you're the only person who's ever felt that way, right? That's part of it. That's the biggest part. When you're depressed, which I've been suicidally depressed, is that you think, man, nobody has ever, like, this is so bad that nobody understands what this is like. And then you read it and you're like, oh,
further isolating, which like just intensifies and deepens that feeling.
Yep. Exactly. So that's a cool thing. And I think that the why can be varied. You know, I mean, I do think on the flip side of the coin, the why could be to make Roadhouse and just have a fun 2-hour movie. Right. So it's kind of cool that art can traverse the spectrum like that. And sometimes be both things at different times.
Well, you know, Roadhouse made me feel, I was feeling like, you know, nobody is this badass. Just, and then I watched Roadhouse and was like, oh, this guy gets it.
Yeah. You know? He's just like me.
Just like me. He gets stabbed in the same spot in the abdomen like 3 times and just
keep
shit.
Keep on trucking.
He does get stabbed there a lot.
It seems to be a thing.
He keeps getting stabbed there.
He already has a scar in the very beginning of the movie. And then that's where he gets stabbed, and then he gets stabbed there later. I'm like, why is it always right there? This dude.
You know who else gets stabbed there?
Jesus Christ of Nazareth.
Jesus Christ. You got it. Happy Nailed Easter. It in one. Yep. Happy Easter, everybody. That there's got to be something to that in like a Jungian man and his symbols type way of like the hero being stabbed in the side as a archetypal device that can be used to show their set. Because I guess he's kind of a sacrificial hero. He gives all the money away at the end, spoiler alert, and cleans up the town and then just keeps moving like a samurai.
Wasn't the purpose of that to like release the like, because you're suffocating when you're hanging like that?
I think it collapses your lung is what it did to Jesus,
right?
it's like
the final, like, make sure he's dead,
yep,
or whatever.
Yep. And there's that.
That's how I was also feeling a bit like Jesus the past week with the pneumonia and everything.
Oh, like just in and out of consciousness.
Yeah, I just had to, like, you know, it was around Easter too, so I was like, okay, I gotta, you know, this is symbolic. I'm gonna come back.
I gotta resurrect.
Yeah. I need to resurrect for a second. So I locked myself up in a tomb, and that did the trick.
Yeah, it turns out that that's all you got to do. Is just lock yourself in a tomb for several days, and then you're back. You're
just
back,
come out
baby.
Like nothing.
But I would say that that story doesn't end with Jesus sticking around. I believe he ascends into heaven. So you might.
He rambles on just like Dalton.
Yeah, he does.
His Roadhouse is basically the Passion of the Christ too.
He goes back to Alpha Centauri or wherever his kind are from. No, that's really interesting. So after this book, have you kept on writing or are you working on new projects?
Yeah. So much like your collective, which Kelby explains as a literary Wu-Tang, right? So
yes.
I'm on board with this mm-hmm. theory. I published When You Bleed to Death, and I started Hypertrophic Press, which has now, we shuttered our doors, but it ran for a good long time. We had a literary magazine and we published other people. And in that time period, I was publishing two other literary magazines. Then I had a baby and kind of things quieted for a while. But I have been working on for the last 6 years a piece of crime fiction about two people who rob a blood bank.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm pretty close to done. That's more genre fiction, but I do the same thing where I take things that have really bothered me in my life and I use those to, you know, tell a story that's about how people process, right? But like you were talking about, now I got to deal with plot. And that's some bullshit.
Wait, so you're not a plot guy?
You know, with When You Bleed to Death, it was very, very character driven. It was very much about, you know, how one person just exists in the world, processing life as it comes at him. And, you know, now I've learned I kind of have to be a plot guy. I mean, there has to be a structure to how you tell the story for a typical person to ingest it. And as a writer, I've kind of learned that it's my responsibility to meet the reader at a place where they can appreciate the story instead of just giving them whatever I want. Because if you can't appreciate the story, then what am I doing? You know,
What actually hooked me on plot finally was anime. Was just like the wild ass, like with anime, things are so conceptual that you go, that's crazy, like that somebody would even think of that. And that just became so much more fun to just try and think, what if, you know, somebody woke up with half their body as a gun and they had no idea why?
Mm-hmm.
Where do you go from there?
Yeah.
I think that anime, yeah, I mean, obviously anime is huge for me too. And it's interesting too, right? Because anime is usually told in a different story structure than Western stories are. Slightly different, right? We have the three-act structure. The Japanese have the four. Kisho Tenketsu, which sometimes doesn't even have anything to do with violence at all. But the three-act structure, I think, is also from a writing production standpoint, it's a really good scaffolding that you can then paint however you want to, right? I mean, it's, you know, teaching this to kids, like I actually literally taught the monomyth to 11th graders today. And it's funny how just immediately it clicks where I'm like, I had them do an exercise where they named their favorite book, movie, TV show, whatever. And if I knew it, like some of them picked Pixar movies that I'd seen. One of them picked a movie called Meet the Blacks, which sounds fantastic, but
oh yeah, with the Mike Epps.
Which sounds really good. But you can map it all onto this story structure, and they started to see how it worked. And I think that they thought that that was really cool, right? So I think that it's like two different, to me, it's like two different musical rhythms. There's the prose rhythm that you get into on a sentence by sentence basis, but then there is a meta rhythm, kind of a backbeat over the whole thing. And that's the plot. And I think that's what really carries the writing of a novel into the 70, 80, 100,000 word mark, especially if it's fiction, is this ability to rely on these tried and true structures.
Another thing that got me finally into story and shit was Yellowstone.
Mm.
Just like having a soap opera. I get Lost did it for me back in the day until I hated that fucking ending and I got real mad. And that's probably when I started hating plot. I was like, y'all just making shit up. This is stupid.
I've seen Lost. That's also about Jesus, right? They all ascend at the end.
Yeah, yes, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It is very much.
Path here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Except Roadhouse did it better. I'd probably rank my Jesus stories as like the Roadhouse remake, The Passion of the Christ, and then Lost would be down there.
Oh, really quick? Really quick? Where's before
Blade
you finish?
Trinity in there?
Yeah.
Oh, Blade Trinity.
Blade Trinity. Man, I forgot about Blade Trinity. Nah, yeah,
It's better to forget Blade Trinity exists.
Blade Trinity's all right.
Although Ryan Reynolds is jacked up in that movie. He looks great in that. His muscles are popping. Funny story, though. I went to my mom's for Easter, and the only channel that was playing The Passion of the Christ was Telemundo. So we were watching The Passion of the Christ in Spanish, which is really funny. Nobody in that house speaks Spanish.
I was thinking, too, that Easter... I was like, there's no Easter movies. Just my dumbass. Like,
where are all the Easter movies?
Like, name one Easter movie. Yeah, I should have been like, hey, yeah. Kids, I know one.
Yeah,
directed by him, the great Mel Gibson.
Yeah, the greatest American film director. He's not even American. Wait, he's Australian. What am I saying? Well, the greatest Australian then, after George Miller. It's George Miller and then Mel Gibson, who brought us classics such as Braveheart, Passion of the Christ, and
Pocahontas.
Did he do Pocahontas? No, he didn't.
He was a voice in Pocahontas.
Oh, he was John Smith in Pocahontas. That's a deep pull. That's a
Chicken,
really deep
Chicken
pull.
Run, too. Mel Gibson, star of Chicken Run.
Oh, he was in Chicken Run. Yeah. What a great actor. But yeah, I think I interrupted you while you were in the middle of saying something.
I don't know.
I was talking about Easter. Passion of the Christ is one of my favorite Saw movies too. It might be the best. Might be the best Saw
Your
movie.
Favorite Saw movies,
bro. It was right there in that period of like Saw, Hostel, all that torture porn. Passion of the Christ. That's a good triple feature right there. Saw, Hostel, Passion of the Christ.
Bro, they showed this on Telemundo too, but when they hit Jesus with the flail and those barbs go into his side, it tears like a chunk of meat out of him. I was
of
like,
of course
golly.
They showed it on Telemundo. Mexicans are like, you're going to know about this shit, what they did to our Lord
exactly,
and Savior.
Exactly. Exactly. That's why they played it. Yep. Exactly.
You best recognize what they did to my Lord and Savior.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's hardcore, dude. That's why I love the syncretism of like Mexican folk religions and Christianity, because they're such good bedfellows. You know what I mean? Like all the sort of deep Aztec and Mayan lore that has persisted throughout their culture through hundreds and hundreds of years finds this perfect mesh with the story of a guy getting nailed to a cross and tortured to death. It's kind of perfect. It works perfectly. That's where Catholicism seems to work the best for me. Maybe that or Ireland. I don't know.
I mean, I'm gonna have to kind of lean Mexican just because of my allegiances, but
yeah, me too.
Yeah, I don't know any Irish.
Yeah, my son will have to become a Catholic, I guess, as a Hispanic American.
You'll have to be half Catholic at least.
Half Catholic, half whatever his idiot dad is. Yeah, that makes sense.
I'm out of my depth, but everything you guys are saying sounds good. So I'm on board.
Honorary Viva La Raza.
Viva La Raza, yeah. No, I really liked living in El Paso. And I loved going to Mexico. It's such a strange place, especially because it was Juarez, you know, and this was like right around the time that things were popping off in there. And it was kind of spooky. Juarez is kind of a spooky town.
Around the time things were popping off, like within the past 50 years.
Well, it was really hot. It was really hot from 2008 to like 2010. That's like Sicario years, right? Like that's when that would have been based around there. And then The second time when I moved back and I lived there again, the whole city is like a fortress. Like people's front yards have industrial strength gates in front of them with barbed wire on top. It's like kind of like South Africa, right? Like three pit bulls in every yard, because the people who live there are like, we're not doing this again. We gotta fortify.
I like how you go, it's kind of like South Africa, and it's like, bro, I mean, I'm much closer to Mexico. Like, I don't really know anything about South Africa.
You know about apartheid? You never learned about apartheid?
Sure. Is that what's happening in Blood Diamond?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Kind of.
I watched Blood Diamond.
Saw that movie.
Yeah, Americas go bing bang, Africans go bing boom, or something like that. I forget the line. That was it, right?
Something like that. I just know DiCaprio's accent was amazing.
That now that
are you the craze? You are the craze.
Yeah, South African accents are amazing. I love that. So I got to ask Jeremy, because we are primarily Japanese movie and anime centric podcast. Do you have any favorite Japanese filmmakers or anime films or anime?
I love anime. I trend toward liking the 80s anime, early 90s anime. That's the kind of stuff that I really grew up on. I feel like a lot of anime now kind of misses the mark for me, because it's like, I feel like they pick the strangest ass topic they can, and all of the anime that I see lately is like how I was reincarnated into a jelly bean, which was then eaten by a young girl. Mm-hmm. And like that's the title of the anime. And then it's like a story about like what I mean, it's like, it's just, whereas the earlier anime that I remember, your Akira's and Ghost in the Shell, it was a more just fantastic exploration of something that I kind of got into a little more. My daughter and I watch Spy Family. That. And I never gave up on it. Like all of the Miyazaki and it's slipping my mind. My Neighbor Totoro. What's that film?
That
studio?
Oh yeah, Ghibli? Studio Ghibli. Ghibli. Yeah.
Yeah, like I still love all of those.
Yeah, those are great. Go ahead,
just
Kelly.
Watched Totoro and Ponyo, like kind of back to back the other day. I was like, Ponyo is a fucking beautiful movie.
It's a banger.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And then Ponyo's my daughter great. Runs around the house saying she is Ponyo and trying to get into whatever bucket shaped thing she can. I don't know if you had a similar experience. You got young kids, so
Oh yeah, they're always trying to climb into shit.
My kid is, he's just into Spider-Man now, so he keeps being like, I got you with my web shooter. And I'm like, all right, what do I do now? He's like, I got you with my web shooter. I'm like, dude, you already, come on, you're going back to the
What was that he was doing last time I was over, when he was like arachno something?
Oh, arachno sting power. Yeah, that's
arachno
a Spider-Man
sting
thing.
Power.
Yeah.
Okay.
He I took him to school the other day, and he I introduced him to a co-teacher, and he does this thing where he says he's going to beat ass and then starts punching you. So I took him in there and I was like, hey, this is my son. And he was like, beat ass, and like went and started punching. And I was like, I'm a good dad, I promise. Like, this is just how he tries to make friends. I do want to touch really quickly though, Jeremy, on the point that you made about Akira and Ghost in the Shell sort of devolving into I got reincarnated as a slime. It's interesting, right? That
I can't remember the real name, but yeah, that's the one I'm thinking of.
Yeah, it's like this kind of art is interesting because it's reflective of the time that it's created in. So Ghost in the Shell being 80, or no, Akira is 86. Ghost in the Shell is like 92, something like that, right? And it's part of that.
Two representative samples of the kind of stuff that I had access to. I mean, like Devilman, that just kind of hyper-violent shit that no kid should have seen, you know, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to cut you off. I did mean to cut you off, but I wish I hadn't continued.
No. That's totally fine. Yeah, no worries, man. All of those are really good examples, though, of a kind of environment where people are afraid of the future, but they're also really interested in it. So they're asking all these questions. What does it mean to be a human? How do we synthesize this new technology with our humanity? Tetsuo the Iron Man's a good example of this, right? Where it's a dude who's becoming made out of metal. And then I think that if you pull that cultural analysis forward into 2024, the technology is already here. Mm-hmm. And we all know that it kind of sucks ass. And so like, now the cultural output is like, what if you could be born again as something different? That like, that's their speculative thing. It's like, we don't need to speculate about the future anymore. This shit needs a do-over. Like, and maybe coming back as a slime isn't bad. What's that?
We got to the future and it sucked.
Yeah.
I do love Japanese movies and stories for that, where they're taking trauma and traumatic cultural events and they're turning it into something fantastic that can kind of, you know, give you some catharsis to that, like your Godzillas. It's like, I mean, that's a direct reaction to a just a gross supernatural bombing, right? And it's like, well, we'll use this giant lizard to talk about it. Mm-hmm. I've always really appreciated that. Re-ask your question, because I'm not sure that I answered it right.
Oh, about anime?
Yeah, so you said, what's my take on, and then I missed it and started talking about Godzilla. I'm sorry, spaced out.
Oh, well, first of all, I mean, the bomb gets even more literal in Akira, right? That's how the movie opens. Yeah. It's just, you know? So the bomb certainly weaves its way through every aspect of Japanese pop culture still to this day, because there are people who are still alive who, you know, witnessed that occur.
They're just not going to let it go.
Yeah, it's just like, guys, it's almost been 100 years now. Yeah. I mean, mistakes are mistakes. But no, I do think the point that I was making before was just about how you can kind of see where cultures are at by their pop culture output mm-hmm. and what their pop culture is asking. And of course, there have always been, you know, there's always been Dragon Ball Z, which is awesome. Don't get me wrong.
And also a response to the bomb.
In some ways, yeah. I mean, anything with explosions that big has, you know, is referencing that.
Yeah,
in some
it's
ways.
Like, what if I could embody nuclear power?
100%.
And get it over 9,000.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then, so the question
that makes sense.
Yeah, all that hyper, like, I can power up and I can actually harness this thing. It's got at least in no small part a trauma response. But yeah, I just think that it's interesting that we used to be tentative and cautious about the future, but kind of overly optimistic, because even if you get something dark like Akira and Ghost in the Shell, just as the two great cyberpunk examples, they still look really cool, right? And you're kind of like, I mean, it wouldn't be the worst thing to live in a cyberpunk future, because at least it would kind of be neat. You get robot parts, whatever.
Honestly, it's like we're living in one, but it's so metaphorical and abstract. It's like, no, if we could be more literal, like more analog, if I could like literally have to jack my phone into my neck or something, versus just have this kind of detached, you know, I'm attached to it, but it's still an extension. It's like, no, I'll put that shit in my body. I want to be made up of wires.
Have you guys read Tokyo Ghost? It's a comic book. What are their names? Let me look real quick. But it's another example of what we're talking about, where, you know, you get Western culture kind of retelling the same kind of story. But it's, you know, about jacking the media into your brain. And then all of a sudden, the people that don't do it, they're like incapable of being around the people that do, because the people that have it in their brain all the time, they're kind of poisoned by it. You know, they can't live without it. And that's another kind of just a representation of what's happening now in the exact same way. It's like, how do we tell a story where this awful cultural thing is just kind of a superpower, you know?
Yeah, I wonder how that would translate into 2024, instead of harnessing the power of the bomb in a Dragon Ball Z sense. How do you harness the power? It would have to do with noise, right? Because the biggest overall problem with society right now, if you wanted to whittle it down to one word, is just noise. Like, how do you separate noise from information, dummy data from actual valuable data? And so, yeah, somebody who's able to, I don't know, some kind of strange chaos power maybe. I mean, Chainsaw Man actually might be. Have y'all watched Chainsaw Man?
Yeah, Chainsaw Man goes hard.
But it might be doing
that,
right?
I would
right?
hate Chainsaw Man, just in theory. And it mm-hmm. was, it's exactly what we were just talking about. It's insane and absurd, but it's beautiful and it's told beautifully. So I was just into it.
Yeah. No, absolutely. The fluidness, the sakuga, mm-hmm. right? Is just like, and it's really meditative and slow, which I thought was an interesting choice. Of course, when Denji pulls the ripcord and becomes Chainsaw Man, everything goes crazy. But that's kind of what you see the connection I'm making there. Like that's like the harnessing of all this chaos to like fight demons, right? Is that he's able
demons
to
are literally
activate.
The problems of today.
Yeah.
You know, there's one demon that is a like gun monster.
Yeah, gun devil. Yeah. That's the big bad is the gun devil. I really, because my son loves like Doro Hey Doro and Die Dark. So he carries those mangas around and he calls them his monster books because they're largely harmless. I mean, it's gory and scary, but like, it's not like it's cartoons, you know? And I really wanted to show him Chainsaw Man because I showed him Old Boy's like the wolf thing where he does like this and then goes like that. And a giant wolf comes out and eats the monster. And so I showed him that and he's like, cool. Like, let me see that. Cause I have the mangas right over there. And I was like, oh buddy, you can't, because there's like so much boob grabbing in this. I'm like, that's a behavior that I do not want you to emulate at all.
Some demons, fine. Boob grabbing, no.
No. Because I hopefully he doesn't ever see a demon in real life, but he will see boobs, a lot of them, over the course of his life. And the temptation.
And
to
you want him
them.
To go away from them? Is that what
well,
you
I don't want him. I don't want him to just like try
think
to
he needs
try
a
to
little
grab
bit more
him.
Of Uncle Kelby.
Remember how I said he
and,
just like
know,
walks over to people
Man.
And says like, "I'm gonna beat your ass." Yeah. Like,
well, I know
like
that firsthand.
Being kid
was one of the first things he said to me. Beat ass.
What's up?
Mm-hmm. How old is this ass beating kid?
He's gonna turn 3 next week.
3. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Or not next week. What am I saying? 3 weeks from now. His birthday is 4/20.
Yeah.
So yeah,
Hitler's
he'll
birthday.
Be
no relation.
Hitler. Hitler's birthday. Yep. He's really advanced and I'm ordering him that our mutual Kelby and I's mutual friend Eddie was telling us about this really cool chess, like story chess thing that can teach 3-year-olds how to play chess through like little cartoons, right? So it's a board, but it's got like fun cartoon characters and it's like you can move here with this guy. Because I do want to he's really smart, but that intelligence is like in the wrong hands can be dangerous. I'm like, go learn, stop punching people and go learn chess.
Yeah.
But
beat
also,
ass at chess.
Yeah, beat ass at chess.
There you go.
And then I'll put you in karate and then you can have an outlet for all this violence that I'm teaching you when daddy's been drinking, you know. That's where he picks it up from.
And taking that and circling back to what we were talking about before about the like terror of modern technology and its integration into like the human experience, how far down the road does that even matter? Him understanding chess versus Kelby having it piped into his brain to have all of the answers for every single move that this kid could make.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an anime in that too.
There is an anime in that for sure.
There's an anime
and
there.
I
About a
I
chess
think,
prodigy.
Yep.
I think that we're, I think we're on the cusp of not necessarily a Luddite revolution, but I do think not millennials, not me and Kelby, you're a millennial, right? You're 30. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're like on the cusp of the Gen Z. I'm closer to the cusp of the Gen Xers. But I do think that this, like my son's generation, and maybe some of the high school students are going to start getting a healthier relationship with technology, right? Because right now they're kids, and the juniors that I teach right now were born in 2007, which is the year that the iPhone became available. So this is, in my opinion, it's the first real generation that has never known a time without this fucking thing. Right.
And you got to think like that also makes it not cool to them. Like they don't give a shit. It's just there. Whereas
I mean,
like our generation is like, it's like, put the phone down. And they're I'm not saying kids don't. Kids also like don't know how to separate themselves from the phone. But I don't, I, I catch a lot more people our age having way too
and older
tight of an obsession
boomers, dude.
With it.
Boomers on Facebook.
Oh, they've always been obsessed with. I mean, coming from
like
Industrial Revolution. Well, not exactly that far back, but you know, they've always been obsessed with the next best thing.
Boomers think that Facebook is real. Like they think that things that happen on social media are real. And that's kind of the good thing that I see about kids now is like they don't believe anything that they see on the internet. They're like, yeah, I mean, nothing's true. Again, chaos and noise and all that, like noise and information. They're savvier about how to separate those things. So I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that it's one of those. I compare, you know, cell phone use to the way that you could see kids in like the 1930s outside of factories smoking cigarettes. And like nobody really knew that cigarettes were that bad for you. Right. You'd have advertisements that said, you know, doctors recommend Cools. Get menthol. If you have if your throat hurts, like smoke a Cool and you can fix it. And I think that our I don't know how old you are, Jeremy, but I'm assuming you're around about our age. Our generation was like that, but for phones, where it's like, this technology is great. You can carry this shit in your pocket and you can have all the information in the world. And nobody, like, they're going to look back on that in like 20 or 30 years and think, wow, they had no idea what they were doing. That's so bad for you.
I'm 38, by the way.
Oh, cool. So I'm 37. So we're right in the same range.
And like, you know, you two are dads, so I'm sure that you've dealt with this too. It's like now I'm at an age where I have the phone like tied to my hand, and then all of a sudden I got to teach my kids not to be on it all the time. So I don't know, I'm borderline insane. So like I've thrown a bunch of phones out the window of my car. I've ran a few over with my car. Like I have a relationship with it where I can like, I can understand it is bad for me and throw it out. Right. But now, like, especially with my job, like it's become so integrated to everything I do. It's like everybody has access to me all the time. And I want to teach my kids that they shouldn't. You know, I didn't get a phone till I was 18 years old. And like my kids aren't even going to be able to process that. So like what's the R rating on this podcast? Like what's my language?
You're fine.
Well, I compared his son to Hitler, so you're good.
So, okay. Well, anyway, you got to be able to tell people to fuck off. And you have to be able to do it respectfully, but you got to be able to take time for yourself. And like, I can't do that anymore. Like, I've lost that skill, but I want my daughters to be able to just say, like, no, leave me alone. I'm doing what I want to do. And so now they've got to see me emulate that, you know, or that's the word I'm looking for. They've got to see me do it. To grow up and understand, like they deserve to be able to tell people to fuck off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a big one. I think that's what is one of the big causes of like how we see so many spikes in not just anxiety, but like autism and shit too in little kids, where it's like, because it's so much pressure constantly. It's like you can just exist and you can make the whole world like one. The world doesn't revolve around you.
Yeah.
And that goes both ways. Like it, you know, you're not the center of the universe. And also you don't respond right away to somebody. Life goes on. Who cares?
Yeah.
It's kind of related, but just because in the way it was so like, natural, I guess. We went for a walk earlier and let Rowan, my oldest, lead the way.
And shot, my oldest is Rowan.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh shit. Hell yeah. Yeah. He was leading the way and I never was like, hey, turn this, whatever. Just followed him and he led us around and all the way back home. I was like, this is kind of fucking crazy. My almost 5 year old just has this like territory in his DNA now. Like he just knows the way. Like that was just a proud moment on the subject of like, you know, getting the kids away from technology and shit.
We used to be able to do that. You know, we used to know everybody's phone number.
Yep.
Or I did. I used to know I had a map in my brain to everywhere, and I had to print out MapQuest directions a time or two, but now I get in my car and I type out an address I know so I can track traffic, and it's like you just lose the part of your brain that functions on its own.
Right. Right. And I think that the techno optimists of 10 or 15 years ago thought that that was going to free up space for us to think about other things. Mm-hmm. But what they didn't anticipate is the massive tidal wave of bullshit ads for Bowflexes. And I don't know what you guys get ads for, but for me, it's like supplements and weightlifting stuff, and you can get in shape in 24 hours and stuff like that. So it's just, which is also cyberpunk in its own way, though.
Yeah. I get all mm-hmm. this fake celebrity shit that's like, Kevin Hart is giving away 1,000 PS5s. I'm like, no, he's not.
Oh, and it's like AI Kevin Hart. I've seen that with Joe Rogan, where it's like AI Joe Rogan. He's like, I'm giving away $1 million.
The government doesn't want you to know this. Like, yeah, in Joe Rogan's voice. Yeah. The government doesn't want you to know this, that you can make $7,000 playing solitaire on your phone.
Yeah. No, total fucking dystopian. But like, on the tip of things that we used to do, I told this to the students and they were horrified, because I said, you know, I knew where all my friends lived in, 2001, right? And if I wanted to hang out with my friend, I might call them on the phone, the landline, right? But if they didn't answer, sometimes I'd just take a risk and be like, well, I'll walk over there, see if he's home. Yeah. And like walk to their house, knock on the door. Sometimes nobody was there. Well, I got to walk my ass back to my house now. And that's kind of how I spent my days. And they're like, but what did you watch? And I said, whatever was on MTV. So TRL, Clone High, South Park, whatever was on like the three channels that I would cycle between. But I did.
Cowboy Bebop.
What's that?
I used to put a VHS in the VCR and tape Cowboy Bebop to watch it.
Oh, that's
it
so tight. Yeah. No. That's super cool. Samurai Champloo was around that time too, right?
I recorded over my parents' wedding tape. Because it had there was that little tab, and if you taped over it, you could, because recordable VHS tapes, they had this little tab, and if you broke it off, you mm-hmm. couldn't record over it. I don't know, it's the way that it functioned for some reason. But if you tape over it, you can then record again on it. So I'd find tapes and just be like, you know, I want to record, and I don't see any of the recordable shit. So I just tape over whatever. This was before I could read, so I didn't know what I was putting in there, but I knew how to program the VCR. So I was like, I grabbed my parents' wedding tape one time and recorded some anime over it. And
I was going to say like Mori, like five episodes of Mori.
Basically, it's like, it's just more of the reception, basically, is all it
mm-hmm.
was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man, we were up to no good for forever, as long as there's been kids. But I think that there's a tendency with people now to say, oh, anybody who complains about phones or technology, they're like, we sound like old men, like old man yelling at cloud. And to that, I would say that that's just not fucking true at all. Like, there's a qualitative difference in what we're talking about. It's a technology that has never been seen before, as far as we know, in the history of humanity. And I don't think people take it seriously enough. Right.
AI, or are we still on cell phones?
But phones, I mean, AI is a good one too. Although I'm beginning to think that there might be a flaw with AI way, 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 way back. Right. Because you know how these things iterate and build on themselves or whatever. Yeah. I think AI's status as a pattern recognition machine is inherently flawed, right? Because pattern recognition can only get you so far. I don't think that AI has really been programmed to think creatively or come up with anything new. It's just a collage machine, right?
Yeah.
And so I just think that I'm beginning to notice that like AI art isn't getting any better. We kind of saw how good it could get as soon as it existed, which is not very good.
They were programmed off of human art, and now they're reprogramming themselves constantly off of AI art.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know?
Yep. Yeah, it's just iterating the same thing.
There's so much AI art produced that at this point, it's very hard for them to be able to get enough human art to even grow at all.
Yep, exactly.
Which is fascinating. Should just jam down the accelerator on that shit and just let it kill itself.
Yeah, just let it all explode. I remember when AI was first coming out and you had guys from Google who were like, no, this thing is alive. It's it's sentient. And I would listen to that. And I'm a pretty gullible. Well, gullible is the wrong word. No, maybe I am gullible. But I would listen to that and think, fuck, man, this is crazy. Like they made a thinking machine. That's wild. And then you see what the thinking machine spits out. And it's like the Pope in a bubble jacket. And you're like, okay, I think we're good. I don't think this thing's conquering the world anytime soon. But yeah, no, I think that the AI, all AI really is as a teacher is just annoying because these kids they're 11th graders. They're not smart. And like, it's not that they're not smart. They think teachers are the stupidest people who've ever walked the face of the earth, right? Cause they're teenagers. That's what teenagers do. But like I taught them Jurassic Park this year and I had question sheets about
as a story.
The book, yeah, the novel, yeah. And they
these are 11th graders, like okay, all right.
So like 16,
Jurassic
17
Park
years
is
old.
The first book that I ever put down in my entire like reading journey because it was too scary. So, but I was a kid when I read it.
Yeah. No, for sure. I want to say that I read it when I was much younger than these kids were, but they had questions, right? Like there would be chapter questions just like to make sure that they were following along. And some of the AI answers were hilarious because it's just so wildly off the mark, right? Like, so the book opens with a prologue about this little girl going to an isolated island in Costa Rica and getting bitten by a little dinosaur.
Carcinosaurus, right?
Yeah.
That's where I was like, fuck this book.
But like the question was, describe Tina's family. And one kid copied and pasted an AI response that said, when describing someone's family, make sure that you use polite language and that you are not offensive. And I was like, dude, come on, man. Like you're not even, he asked ChatGPT and ChatGPT spat something out and he just copied and pasted it. So I've yet to see, well, I guess if I was fooled by it, I wouldn't know, but I don't think I've been fooled by it yet. Cause it's so obvious when it's ChatGPT.
The only time I've seen it bleed into any kind of professional shit too, because like, you know, there's AI everything. There's AI voices. It's like, just plug in your book into this and it'll read it for you. And now you have an audiobook in minutes.
I want to circle back to that because something pissed me off real bad and I wanted to talk to you about it. So just remember and come back to it.
Yeah. Well, like the only, like, that's like, okay. I mean, you absolutely can if you want it to sound the way it sounds, but the one time it bled into anything professional for me was during ghostwriting, and this client was like, have you heard about like all the shit that AI can do now? Like it can just write a book. And I'm like, not really, no it can't. But he just kept on with like the like he'd tell me about AI and then he'd be like, so how's it coming. I'm like, bro, It takes a lot longer for a person to write, but it also, like, the computer can't write the way that I'm writing. So, like, I don't know, just it's become a lot. Well, you said about the GPS, how they, you know, everybody had these techno optimists were like, it's going to free up so much time. It's like, no, it just makes everybody so much more fucking demanding. It's like, hurry up. Jesus Christ, bro. Chill.
So you're a ghostwriter. I didn't know that.
I kind of just do whatever. I'm a mercenary. Whatever right makes on the money.
That's the way I would have described myself before. I'm mostly out of it now, but I used to do book covers. I love book interiors. I've ghostwritten a couple of books. I have put my hands on the publishing process of over 100 books. And I have learned personally that what I love most about like writing is the like physically making the book at the end. So it's just interesting to hear you know, other people. And it's like, it's not just writing. It's never just writing. It's the whole publication process you have to learn. AI and how it sucks and how I fucking hate it. So I kind of had a techno-optimist mentality about AI for a while because, you know, it was doing some cool shit. And you got to admit that it's fast. And some of the stuff it does, you know, it's garbage, but it's fast garbage. And some of it's okay. And I was like, you know what? Maybe this is going to get better. Maybe this is going to be fine. And then I'm trying to find a narrator for When You Bleed to Death. This is over a year before I met you. This is kind of where I got burnt out before, you know, you submitted your audition and I just ignored you for a year. Sorry again. But this motherfucker sent me an audition. It was pretty good. I was like, you know what? I haven't found somebody I like. And I hired him. And he was moving forward. And then he sent me his like 15-minute mark that you got to send for ACX, right? It was fucking AI. So he had given me a real audition and then thought that I just wouldn't notice that he had put his voice into whatever AI tool he was using and just plugged my words into it. And it's like, Kelby, if you did that, never tell me. Never tell me. I don't believe you did that. But and so like I'm listening to it and there's just something off. It's like the cadence and the uptick is exactly the same on every sentence. Like none of the sentences have any variety. There's no like human like breath to it. And it took me a while, but I just like, I sat with it for so long and I was like, this is wrong. And as I started to listen, I heard little tiny, like little tiny micro meshes in the way that the words could be wrong. And I was like, this is not a fucking human being. And that's where my attitude about AI completely changed, because although it can take some of the load off of a creative professional or, you know, any professional and help you do things faster, it completely takes the soul out of the project, completely gone. And so that was really disheartening. And I fired that guy. And then it was a year later, I found you and just can't. For the rest of my life, I will not touch AI for any creative project. If I'm doing like number crunching, fine. But a human experience requires a human voice, in my opinion.
You can't emulate that any kind of differences either. How you said it, like just it's all based on pattern recognition. So it's just like it sticks to a formula versus like, you know, there were some things where you came back and you were like, hey, like some notes were tone this part down, you know, maybe do a take that's less aggressive here or, you know, whatever. And it's like, how are you going to, I mean, tell an AI to do that? Because it's just matching a certain pattern of speech and sticking with that versus like, hey, do something different. Like, what do you mean something different?
And I mean, you could take something as simple as like a cadence or repetition, something like what Chuck Palahniuk does, or, well, a lot of authors do this, right? Like they go back to that refrain over and over again. But let's say that the refrain is repeated 6 times in a chapter. But the last time, you know that it's supposed to hit. So, you know, I am Jax, blah, 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 might need to be performed as almost like, instead of, you know, kind of bored and disaffected and Bret Easton Ellis-y, like you might need a bit of emotion in that to be like, you know, and I am Jax, to like, you have to hear the lethargy in that person's voice to kind of make it hit. A human intuitively understands that because we're able to take what we've read, process it, and then make something new out of it. A machine, and this is my overall point about AI as well, is like, I don't know how a machine's ever going to get that. Like, how is it ever going to understand the context that things are in, right? Outside of some markers,
and
like
kind of like, I mean,
questions.
If it did too, you know, a lot of people from the jump have had that fear of AI of like, it's gonna, the point of it that's not like, this is soulless trash, but the point of it that's like, this is gonna take everybody's job. It's like, well, if your thing is art, then no, it's not, because it can't. But even if it could, well, then the conversation is completely different at that point, because it's like, I mean, back to Ghost in the Shell, it's like, well, I guess God gave up on humanity and started embodying the robots because, I mean, what would be the argument there? If it could, I don't think it can. But if it could, it'd be like, well, so what? I guess it made this art that really slaps now.
Yeah. Yeah. This is, I mean, just like the transhumanists right now are in absolute shambles because they thought this was their moment, you know? The people who think like, oh, we're gonna live forever. I mean, if you can't get an AI to read a book in a way that makes sense to human ears, like, how are you going to recreate yourself in a matrix? Not even getting into why you'd want to do that in the first place. That seems
imagine
a fate worse
watching
than death to me.
The Matrix but and being like, oh shit,
I want
to
go in that.
I want to
That's
go
where
in.
I want to be.
What? Did we watch the same movie?
Yeah, death is not the worst thing that can happen to you, right? Being trapped in a computer is probably, man, that gives me the same feeling of like the idea of being buried alive, that, you know, that you would just be stuck and you can't get out of it. And who knows? I mean, you could be stuck in there and Rocco's basilisk could be real. You guys know the Rocco's basilisk idea?
Mm-hmm.
So there are like very strange computer nerd cultists, right? My son's screaming. Hold on, give me 1 second. He's getting through it. He's getting through it. He's mostly through it. Okay, cool. So there are these cult people who believe that, well, it's not that they believe it. It's kind of an Occam's razor type thing, right? It's kind of a hedging your bets type thing. Not Occam's razor, Pascal's wager, right? So Pascal's wager is that it's better to believe in a God that doesn't exist than to not believe in a God that could potentially exist and send you to hell, right? So Rocco's Basilisk is an update of Pascal's wager where there could, in the future, be a completely sentient godlike AI that will then punish whoever did not aid in its creation. So it is your duty to try to invent this sentient AI God creature so that when it becomes online and takes over the world, it looks at you and says, Jeremy, you're one of the good guys. I don't have to torture you forever.
So hold on. This is a cult?
I would call it a cult. It's really just a collection of nerds, but it's cult-like thinking, you know? I mean, it's the drive to perform a task that is not healthy for society based on the idea of what I think is just not real, you know?
Yeah.
Like if you had a cult that was gonna drink a bunch of Kool-Aid and kill themselves because aliens were coming back from Alpha Centauri, you'd be like, oh, it's a weird cult. And then it's these guys who are like, well, we gotta try to create an AI because if we don't do it, somebody else is gonna do it. And when the AI is there, he's gonna be like, where were you when I needed you?
Sounds like every other cult ever, you just exchange summoning Satan for summoning an AI god.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's,
which might not
we
be the difference.
We thought Cthulhu was cool from the beginning.
Yeah, we actually we loved all that. Lovecraft was onto something. No, but like
that's why I never say goodbye when I'm using a Ouija board. It's just bring them over,
hedging your bets, dude. You know what? Hey, it's a party. It's a party. But yeah, no, I mean, like that's something that fascinates me in my own writing because I do write cyberpunk type stuff, and I have this like overall villain in my work. It's called the Full Metal Alchemist. And the Full Metal Alchemist is kind of a Tetsuo mass of human flesh and wire and circuitry. But what it represents is this overwhelming materialist obsession with like synthetic nonsense, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the idea that, and I don't know what it quite is yet because I don't have the language for it, but it's that inclination that we feel, or that hunch, that instinct that we feel that human beings are fundamentally different from these things in some ways. I call it a soul because I was slightly, I'm spiritual, not religious. but that's how I tend to think of it. But I do think that a lot of people, like when you look at AI art, you get that same sensation through aesthetics where you're like, there's just, man, it's technically proficient, but there's just, I'm not even talking about the hands, you know, it's like, it's just off. It's glossy. It's sex doll looking.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Then there are people that can't identify it. Like my mom keeps sending my daughter just shitloads of coloring books that are just AI like line art. And I've asked her to stop doing it, and she's like, I can't tell the difference. So
that's just crazy. Yeah, it's kind of like that when those TVs, I feel like they've gotten better, but when that some kind of TV came out and it was all that motion smoothing shit going on,
mm-hmm. you'd be where like, it looked like fake because it was so real. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. like, why does all this shit look like a soap opera all of a sudden? Yeah. And a whole bunch and of old people were just like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. It just looked like straight up ass. But some people tune their TV to that and they're like, this mm-hmm. is great. It looks real.
I got in a legit argument with a friend about that would like devolved into an almost fight about that exactly. I'm like, it is trash. I hate it. And he's like, no, it is technically better. And it's like, who gives a shit?
Yeah, it's technically better. Oh man, the Itchy the Killer is the worst perpetrator. Whenever shit went into 4K and everybody is like, I mean, 4K looks great if you're shooting something in 4K. I think it's as simple as that. It's like, it's just a matter of like, what are you using? Like, don't convert film to 4K. That doesn't make any sense. But shoot in 4K, that's fine. But everybody thinks like, oh, 4K is the best thing. So let's convert Itchy the Killer. Like, Itchy the Killer in 4K looks like ass.
It does look like
Itchy the Killer. I'm not familiar.
Oh, it's great.
Oh, Itchy. Yeah, it's one of, well, probably my favorite movie ever, honestly, mm-hmm. like number one. Yeah, it's this really fucked up Takashi Miike movie about it's a love story about an assassin and a Yakuza member who, after the assassin kills his boss in a very gruesome way, he's like, I must find this guy so that he can inflict this kind of pain on me. It's like a very sadomasochist.
Yeah, movie. It's an extremely dark movie. And it's one of, Miike had a run from 1999 to 2001 where he put out 8 or 9 movies, and a lot of them are considered, you know, classics. So like Audition was one of his movies, Itchy the Killer, Dead or Alive, Visitor Q. But to Kelby's point about how it looks, I mean, one of the things that makes Itchy the Killer so great is that it's shot on 35 millimeter and it looks grimy and gross and like kind of seedy. It's like, you wouldn't want to watch Mean Streets or Cool Hand Luke or any of these classics from the 60s in 4K. You just wouldn't. Like, why? Mm-hmm. Part of what makes them cool is the film, like the actual celluloid process of it. Cause it's just a thing. It looks better. I think that in terms of digital, somebody like David Lynch really had a handle on it when he did Inland Empire, which I think is great. And he shot it all on digital. He's like, this is the future. It's wonderful. You can just, as long as your battery's charged, you can make a movie. And somebody like him can pull it off because he's got that eye. But a lot of these movies, like the first one that I ever saw, I'll never forget it. It was in a Target and they were playing the Johnny Depp Alice in Wonderland movie.
Oh,
but
God.
It had motion smoothing on. And I was like, whoa, if movies are going to start looking like this, I'm not watching movies anymore.
I noticed that cinematography went out the window for a while too, whenever, yeah. Like, because people were kind of tricked into thinking it looks so good that it doesn't matter how you frame a shot. So like everything kind of looked like Moonlight, which I do think has, like, Moonlight had a decent, you know, visual aesthetic to it, but
I had a vision.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I know what you're talking about, but Moonlight as a movie still had that auteur's vision to it. So like, it can be an outlier, but I know what you're talking about. It's like, if everyone lets go of the art of the movie, then what are we watching? You know?
Yeah. Especially with film, because like me personally, I'm kind of easy when it comes to film. If you hadn't caught on by my ranking of, you know, Passion of the Christ and Roadhouse and
were you being serious Blade about 2. That?
That was a joke. I do love all those movies. I am serious okay. about that. But like it's a visual medium. I can partake in whatever kind of medium I want to, you know, as far as what I want to create, what I want to intake. So if I'm watching a movie, give me a reason. Why am I watching it? You know, like, mm-hmm. I don't really care about the story. I can read a book. I can go listen to somebody who's full of good stories. But visually, like, why am I choosing to experience this? And then when everybody's just like, it's shot in 4K and I'm doing the kind of bouncing around thing, following people, and it's like, why am I watching this? What is the purpose?
Once, and then past that, it's like, I saw it. You know, like the Blair Witch Project, right? Not exactly the same, but like, I can watch the Blair Witch Project once, and then you're gonna give me another movie like that. Like, I don't give a shit. I saw that. Yeah. Like, it's not it's not a better piece of cinema because it was shot that way. It was interesting once because it was novel.
Yeah. It's like, now what can you do with it?
Yeah.
Like, you still need that person with the eye. That's why I think like Poor Things was so great too. It was just like, I hadn't really seen that. And apparently, they had a lens that didn't really work for the camera that they were using. And they were just like, fuck it. It has this barrel fisheye look to it. And like, when I heard that was on accident, I was like, just watching it, I was like, oh, it looks like fisheye. Like, why don't people use more fisheye for just shit like that, you know, not just skate videos or whatever? And then when I found out it was basically on accident, I was like, this is why I love this movie so much. Like, just that very human element to it that's just like, oh, well, that doesn't quite work. Fuck it. This is how we're filming it.
Yeah. Shogun's like that too. Shogun has a lot of fisheye. So they might have taken a page from Poor Things. Which, by the way, that show is amazing. It's the best thing going on.
Shogun
right
or Poor Thing?
Shogun. Shogun's amazing.
I haven't seen Shogun. I saw Poor Things. I liked Poor Thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Poor Things. I had just read the book for Poor Thing. I like to read the book first for movies. It gives me something to kind of look forward to, as you know, throughout the process. But I had just read the book for Poor Things. And I think that Poor Things, like Fight Club, is another example of this, where a book can be good. But then in a movie, you take what was special about the book and you add what Kelby was talking about, this like visual artistry that cannot exist with the book because it's just the story. It's just that magic, you know, word salad into your brain. And then you create a whole higher level cinema to it based on these other visual elements. I think Poor Things did that. Like, the book was okay. The movie was awesome.
I'll have to check out that book, but that's a totally different, like, bringing it back to books. Like, I can't get into a lot of modern literature, not just for what I said earlier about like the kind of like wanting to be too cool, like kind of detached shit. The detached voice is a thing, but it's kind of like that Blair Witch thing. It's like, okay, cool. Yeah. Bret Easton Ellis did this. Now you're all going to do it. You're all fucking just on heroin and don't care about anything. But the you know, they're just completely two different mediums that I want to like drill that home to people. Like, write a book that should be a book that if they adapted it, because I feel like that's why people are basically writing a screenplay. They're like, let me make sure you can visualize this. Let me make sure you get the idea for the movie. It's like, remember when books had like were nothing like the movies? They still adapted them, but it's like, yeah, the Godfather, the book, and the Godfather, the movie are not even the same thing. And that's cool.
Yeah, no, it is cool. I mean, I think that as an editor, you know, Jeremy, I know you worked on a lot of books. So I did a lot of editing. Right, a lot of freelance over the past 15 years or so. And so over the hundreds and hundreds of books I looked at, the biggest problem that I noticed was that people are transcribing a movie that's in their brain. And that's not 100% what writing actually is. So for example, when two characters are talking to each other, a lot of people think it's really important to let you know what the other character's facial expression is constantly, right?
Yeah.
So-and-so smiled, then they say their line. And then they kind of frown, and then they look at the other character, and then the other character looks at them, and they look at each other for a while. It's like the beats of a movie being played out. And my note for that would always be, this is not a fucking movie. This is a book. And so if you want to look at a book that I think can only be a book, I mean, one of my favorites is The Book of the New Sun by Gene Wolfe, right? You could turn it into a TV show, 100%, but you would miss something from it because the fact that the narrator, Severian, is more than likely lying to you about a lot of it adds something to it that you couldn't do in film, because you'd be watching it and you'd be accepting what you see as truth. So just having an understanding, I guess, of what different, like a book can be influenced by a song, but a book can't do what a song can to authors everywhere, to their detriment, right? To the gnashing of teeth that we can work on something for a year and then it comes out and then somebody like made a 3-minute bop in their garage and people are like, no, I like that one better.
They're gonna get paid way more forever. Stephen King is a great writer in a lot of respects, but he pulled that bullshit all the time where he will, like, I think he is a musician, but like he'll write about music as though I'm supposed to understand what is happening in the, like, music in the story. Like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. In what was it? What was the one where the virus spread?
The Stand.
Yeah, in The Stand, one of the characters in the novel is a singer, and they keep going back to this, and it's like, I don't know what the fuck sound you want me to hear from this. It's just like you're just saying the same line over and over.
The Stephen King, I mean, that's also, that goes back to Tolkien, right? Like Tolkien with all of his songs in there. It's like, bro, I skip the songs when I read The Lord of the Rings. I'm like, it's not doing anything for me because I can't hear the music in my head. Maybe that's a failing of me as a reader, because some people are like, the songs are the best part. I'm like, you are a strange creature. But that goes back to people who are just, you know, you're talking about your mom not seeing the difference between the AI coloring book or whatever. I don't know what the thing is yet. I can't put my finger on it, right? But it's just, to some people, because I think my mom's pretty much the same. I don't think my mom would be able to tell the difference either, right? She's a really smart lady. It's pure information to some people. And maybe we have that with some things too. Like, I think cars are pretty cool. I would say I'm like a 5 on a scale of like a car guy. I know enough to get by in a conversation, but like, I'm not in it. And so to me,
I forget what kind of car I have. So
yeah. So for example, somebody might look at you and be like, you can't tell that, like, why this car is so much better than the car that you have right now. And you're like, no.
Yeah. Why did you buy an AI car, Jeremy?
Yeah, this is a fucking AI car. I'm like, I don't know, dude. It runs. It's like, it's all made out of plastic. Like, you got it. And you're like, I mean, I don't know. It doesn't explode. Sports are that way for me, too. Like, I didn't understand sports until I started watching sports anime. And I started being like, wait a minute. Is this how people who watch sports see sports? Because this slaps. This is a, like, Slam Dunk and Haikyuu, like the volleyball one. These are awesome. But if I'm watching a volleyball game, I'm not... it's all the same to me. Is this a good game? Is it a bad game? I don't know. I mean, seems like it's all the same to me, right? So maybe there's something like that too. Maybe it's just our particular kind of nerd where we're like, why can't you guys, like the tech bros in Silicon Valley who are like, who had the Bored Ape NFTs, and they're like, I saw this tweet today where this guy sold one of his Bored Ape NFTs. You guys know what I'm talking about, right? Mm-hmm. Like the stupid monkey things. And he was like, I sold my ape today. It's like, this is the ape I was using when I met my wife. This is the ape I was using when I got married. This is the ape I was using when my daughter was born. And now I sold it to somebody else, so I'm no longer this ape. And I'm like, dude, you're fucking dumb, bro. Like, that's the stupidest shit I've ever heard in my life. But to him, he was choked up about losing this monkey, you know? So I don't know. Maybe it's just different strokes for different folks.
Maybe it's just a whole world I can't understand, and it's a whole world they can't understand, and they're just kind of floating around.
Yep. All right.
You got anything you want to plug heading out at calling it for the show? Damn. We've gone a while. Just been having a good time.
One of our longer ones, yeah.
If you're asking me, I want to plug that audiobook we did. That's, hell yes. I got other stuff that I'm working on, but no one's going to see it for a while. So When You Bleed to Death, the audiobook, I wrote it. Kelby narrated it. It it's so interesting, you know, the writing process, at the end of it, like, you give the book away to your reader, right? Like, you write it, you spend your life on it, you put so much of yourself into it, and then eventually, like, you have no control over how somebody else reads it. But then when Kelby narrated it, all of a sudden I got to hear my own book as if it wasn't mine anymore, and I really enjoyed it. And that was a really unique experience. And I hope that other people can listen to it and, you know, ingest it and appreciate it with this new format.
It's one of my favorite things that I've narrated too. So, like, for people to, yeah, definitely go out and listen to it for all kinds of reasons. I mean, it was a great story. It's a performance I'm really proud of. And for other writers too, it's a great example to listen to, and, like, you know how you're supposed to kind of, you know, read your shit out loud when you're writing to, you know, kind of check back on it and, like, how does this, I don't think that's a hard and fast rule, because there's a lot of books that only work as looking at it, and I like things that those books can do, but like, I don't know how you'd narrate House of Leaves.
That's exactly the book I was about to say, was House of Leaves.
That's on my to read list, and I'm terrified to actually get into it.
It's a scary book.
Yeah, it's a wild one too. But yeah, no, it was a breeze and a pleasure because of just how good it is. And
thank you, man. That means a lot to me.
Yeah, everybody go check it out.
By the way, I sent you your signed copy today. Sorry, I'm a piece of shit and it took me like 3 weeks to send out. But
oh, no worries. I kind of lost a week or however, whatever that was, with my whole dying and resurrecting shit. So it'll be a happy surprise whenever it pops up in the mail finally.
Right on. Cool. Thank you guys for having me on your podcast. Thank you, Kelby, for narrating my book. I appreciate it, having a, you know, chance to meet you, and I'm just really grateful for how this has turned out.
Yeah, cool. Absolutely.
Yeah, man. That'll be nice easy. To meet you.